Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio 1360 AM in Dallas, Texas. We have, as usual, a very, very special show today. Today, my guest is going to be American intellectual Gore Vidal. We'll be right back with Gore Vidal after this break.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. Those who send their children off to die in robber class wars. Those who lack proper health care. Those who are denied decent education. And those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today, our special guest on the Soapbox is Gore Vidal. Gore is an American novelist, screenwriter, playwright, essayist, short story writer, actor, and politician. Early in his career, he wrote the groundbreaking The City and the Pillar in 1948, which outraged mainstream critics as one of the first major American novels to feature unambiguous homosexuality. By such actions as his vast output of essays and a public debate with William F. Buckley Jr., Vidal has long been known as one of the most prominent public intellectuals of the 20th century. Welcome to the show, Gore.
Well, I'm happy to be on it.
Well, I have some great wishes from all my listeners. They hope that you're feeling well, because we had you planned a few weeks ago, but your health wouldn't permit it. So my listeners are very excited you're going to be on the show. I'm very excited. And so thank you for taking the time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Good. And I'm so my gallbladder was so excited that we had to remove it so that I could go on comfortably. And here I am without a gallbladder.
Well,
and I cut the brain.
One of the best afternoons I ever spent was at your home, and I know you have millions of fascinating stories from all your experience, just being so involved in the American situation for so many years. But the first thing I'd like to ask you today, and that my listeners are very interested in, how do you evaluate the Obama administration in its first 6 months, where you have been really a pretty strident critic of the two-party, the so-called two-party system here in America?
Well, I'm glad you said so-called.
Yeah.
It seems like the Democratic Party is four parties now. You know, there's the very right wing, the so-sos, and so on. I would say, just to kick the ball a bit, I'm alarmed by Obama.
Uh-huh.
I became alarmed when he was talking about the secret to victory, and God knows it's so important for Americans to win because we're number one,
right?
Except where we're number 1 million from the bottom. And it's so important that we win in the Middle East, And somehow or other, his predecessors had forgotten Afghanistan.
Right.
And we are the natural heirs of Alexander the Great. Well, he failed to conquer it, too. It was called the Kingdom of Bactria back in those days.
Right.
He didn't get very far, and we're not getting very far either. But a lost war is a great feather in the cap of any president. And I think that he got off on the wrong foot, and he's staying on the wrong foot on practically every issue that comes up. What is he doing apologizing to this cop for? You know, I have never belonged, that I was aware of, to any, you know, hated minority.
Right.
And yet at the same time, I have been a dissident politically, as have you, and we all get hassled by the police.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we're all quite used to it.
Right.
I no more believe Sergeant Crowley than I would believe the Tooth Fairy if I were told that tomorrow there'd be a pile of gold in the backyard. There isn't going to be.
Well, Obama has a history of, like, distancing himself from people who tell the truth, like his pastor Jeremiah Wright.
Well, we all make mistakes, and we all have friends that we wish they wouldn't say that, you know, or wouldn't do that. I mean, I can see how the Reverend was, you know, an honest mistake that had accumulated like a, you know, snowball rolling down a hill over the years, and he didn't quite know how to get out of it.
Uh-huh.
I've had my Reverends in my lifetime, and I'm sure you've had them too, that you wish they'd just shut up, even though it's really no business of ours what other people think, or at least I don't think so. And I'm not interested in psychoanalyzing presidents. They're a lousy lot, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And his gift, the eloquence gift, was, I think, a great plus in that election. We had somebody who could talk, somebody who was intelligent, somebody who was at home with the English language in the way that, you know, most of our politicians can't use it at all, just through sheer incompetence and deadheadedness. And I thought, oh, well, he's going to be a nice change. And he was a nice change for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he started talking about those 17 million that were going to be fighting in Afghanistan, I thought, dear God, the Pentagon has you by the throat. And you believe those guys? Why not ask General Petraeus, did you ever fight in a battle? Did you ever win a battle? I'd get the whole lot of them up, the lot of generals. These are staff men. They're used to dealing in dry goods, linen, and uniforms, sometimes food.
Well, you talked about, you became alarmed when Obama started talking about victory in the Middle East. And as far as I've been paying attention, and it's same as the Bush administration, victory is not defined. That's the first problem, I think.
Well, the war is illegal, and we are the illegal people who started it. The average American says, oh, that guy in Iraq was horrible. We had to get rid of him. Well, we didn't. He was an ally of the United States of America, and God help his soul. All of our allies, you know, the United States, from almost the beginning, acts in bad faith with everyone else,
mm-hmm.
but really bad faith. I hear that as we hanged him, his head fell off.
Oh, right.
Well, as it fell off, I just thought, I hope he had 1 second, a flash, as it were,
mm-hmm.
a final flash, that wonderful phrase when John Quincy Adams, who had gone back to the Congress, as an old man, he died on the floor of the House of Representatives, and he said, this is the last of Earth. He was a great man, and he also warned us against getting involved in foreign adventures. We paid no attention to General Washington when he did that.
Right.
J.Q. Adams was even more eloquent than Washington, and he said, you know, the United States does not go forth to search for dragons in foreign lands, dragons to slay. Because if we did, we could become mistress of the world.
Right.
And we would lose our soul.
Well, and barely 200 years later, those prophecies are coming true. When I travel the country now, people who opposed Afghanistan under George Bush seemingly are supporting it now because Obama's president. And one of the biggest reasons they tell me is we should be in Afghanistan is to liberate the women. What do you think about that rationale
for war? Well, I think every society does what it wants with its men and its women, and we've never interfered in other societies, what they do. Is that cruel at times, and shouldn't we get upset over what happened to Cousin Hattie, who happens to teach school on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers? Hell, I know, I can see it. There is interference at times, which sometimes seems like a good idea. But most times our interference... Look, we are the most uneducated country on the face of the earth. There's nothing that people learn in the schools that is worth knowing, and they know it eventually. We've got a blind population. They're just staggering along, trying to figure out where they are and to make sure they don't fall off the edge of the country.
Right.
Which is, of course, flat.
Right.
And I suspect that the most ignorant of the First World people, us, ought to stay out of things we don't understand. And we ought to have leaders who would lead us, you know, like rubber dumb children from No, Don't Stuff the Beans Up Your Nose, that famous story about children. Don't tell them that ever, because before you know it, there won't be a bean in view.
Right. Well, I think, of course, our leaders, and like you said, Obama, the Pentagon has Obama by the throat now, and he was going to release the torture photos, but the generals like that horrible, who I call Stanley the Goon McChrystal, went in and said that if we release the torture photos, that it would harm the troops in the field. And I you know, call me whatever, but I think that the actual torture is what harms our troops in the field.
Well, if you torture the enemy, when he catches one of you, he's going to torture whomever it was he captured. That's his first law of war. Now, you must remember that our leaders for 20 years have been noticeable cowards.
Mm-hmm.
They're people who wouldn't fight in any wars, but there were a lot in favor of them. If there was money to be made out of it.
Right.
So to have the most cowardly ruling class, I mean, look at the Bush people. Has anybody read that you come across a marvelous book called Family of Secrets?
Actually, I had the author, Russ Baker, on my show a few weeks ago.
Oh, good for you.
Yes.
If I had a show, I'd have him on mine.
Yes.
It's a great book.
Tell my listeners what you thought about.
And you wonder how a civilized country would allow this family, who make the Borgias look like Santa Claus and his merry minions.
Mm-hmm.
This is an evil family, and we deserve just what we got.
Well, you said civilized country, so you know there's a qualifier there. I know, to me, having George Bush, this failure, and his father and grandfather, who were just outright murderous criminals, as one of the leading families in our country, says a lot about our country.
Well, they're not one of the lead. Look, this is the media does this, and PR people do this. I mean, when I see when Mrs. Bush was swaggering around as a great lady, they aren't great ladies and great gentlemen, and God knows they're not great statesmen. These are cowards.
Uh-huh.
And crooks. And by God, there's enough on them. And if you don't think there is, listeners, I suggest that you write to the Congress of the United States in care of Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio, who has prepared articles of impeachment, which is what you must do if you're being orderly, against first of all, George W. Bush, and also against Vice President Cheney. And it's exquisite work, but unfortunately, times change, elections change, and they were gone. But they could have been all sent up the river.
Well, that's a question I was going to ask you about, because I know that you were focused a lot on impeachment and accountability, but it's still not too late. You know, theoretically, it's not too late to impeach them, but we know that's not going to happen.
Impeachment is a technical term for people who are in office.
Right, but they still receive...
The two principal clowns out of office.
They still receive federal benefits. So
they get all kinds of things.
Right.
Well,
Secret Service protection, health care.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about the little things. I would get them on crime.
So...
And I think the book that I gather you admire, and I admire, A Family of Secrets, it's very clear. This isn't just, he forgot the Constitution when he invented whispering. You whisper to a law that the president will never enact it. Boy, isn't that, my God, what would Jefferson and Madison and Marshall have done with that one? And there they are. This is all actionable. And here we are. You know, we have the Constitution vanished. I remember the day it did, when we lost due process of law. And that was when we got rid of one of the few nice things the Brits left us when they departed our shores, was what happened at Runnymede, what happened to Magna Carta.
Right.
That was our heritage, and that was the legal heritage out of which our country came. And it was a country that worked very well until the thieves grabbed it. And since we cannot face the fact of any kind, it's just an American trait. Oh, well, he's really all right. Now, I don't think that's very important. They all do it. If I hear an American say they all do it next time, I will submit to Sergeant Crowley.
Well, it's like we're excusing our politicians because we set the bar so low that if they, it's almost like anybody can roll over the bar. It's set so low. And that's just one of the problems. That's why they get away with everything, because it's just like you said, they all do it. When I spent some time with you at your house there, we talked a lot about the Kennedy administration because you were very...
I knew them well.
You knew them well. And a lot of people have compared the Obama White House to the Kennedy White House, calling it like a new Camelot. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, they don't know any history. They don't know any fairy tales. They don't know anything. But why should they? You know, people are saying, well, I don't know where you get your information. In the old days, they thought I was a commie, and obviously I was getting orders from Pravda.
Right.
And I said, well, I get it from, I've spent half my life in Italy as well as in California, which arguably means I don't live in the United States at all.
Right.
However, you can learn a lot in both Italy and California.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there. But where do you look? If you haven't had a geography lesson in your life, and this is true of most of the population now, I started tracking elementary education when I got out of the Army, and that was back in 46. And I was just curious, because after all, I am writing American history, and I was curious to see how it's taught. Well, everything is wrong. Everything is fudged over, and blatant lies are told and got away with because there's nobody around to say, well, that was a lie. Nobody can say that. Generally, the idea is, well, you know, and he believes that. I mean, everybody's got a right to his beliefs. What happens is they turn everything into religion as though, well, I don't know. I disagree with you. My opinions are just as good as yours. To which my answer is they're not. In most cases, I spent my life studying American history, and you haven't spent 5 minutes on it.
Right.
Except to get it all wrong.
But you were intimately involved in the so-called Kennedy Camelot. And I, you know, we did talk about that, and it wasn't so much a fairy tale around the Kennedy White House a lot of the times.
I wouldn't say it was a fairy tale at all. It was a very ambitious family of no particular gifts except for the president himself. And he was enchanting and very, very bright. And I won't say I was ever taken in by him. I knew him too well. But what I liked about him was his candor. You know, he couldn't really lie beyond the ordinary politician lies.
Right.
Like, it's great to be here in Akron again. He told those lies.
Yeah. I tell those all the time, too.
And the idea that there was some golden moment that was Camelot, I mean, wouldn't you just take a sappy song from a musical comedy? I know that Arthur Schlesinger, who was a loyalist to the Kennedys to the end of his days, and I used to criticize him for that. I said, you want to believe every lie about so-called Camelot? So he said, one thing, Gore, I've got to tell you, I hate the word, and I hate the reference.
Mm-hmm.
That it's really a musical comedy that was going on in Washington. He said it was real politics, I know. I said, I remember the Bay of Pigs, and the invasion that went wrong.
Right.
I remember the missile crisis that
right.
almost blew us all up. That was all Jack was doing. He was bright enough to get himself out of that one. And I suppose that kind of intelligence I have not seen in the presidency since then, nor has anyone else.
Well, people compare, you know, think that Obama's brilliant just because he succeeded somebody who, had the IQ actually George Bush has a very low IQ, and I don't see the comparison that way. I think that our next president, whoever it was destined to be smarter than George Bush.
Well, everybody else in the country was brighter than George Bush,
right.
too.
Exactly.
I think that made him rather popular. It's very mm-hmm. nice knowing the president's dumber than you are.
Right.
But not exactly healthy.
No, for sure. In that book, Family of Secrets, one of the most fascinating things that I've learned about was that Russ Baker thinks that there is a connection between George H.W. Bush and the Kennedy assassination.
It's fascinating, yeah. Well, you see, being a good researcher, he knows things that most contemporary historians don't understand. He was correct in making it a family affair, family secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And what was George Bush, the father,
right.
doing in Dallas on the day Jack was killed? What was he doing there? He'd been head of the FBI. He was marinated to his eyeballs in CIA tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was dodging all over the place, which is fascinating to read about. I've never seen it anywhere else except in that book.
Right.
That he was dodging all over to get alibis for himself and the dreadful wife.
Mm-hmm.
As if, why would they need them? You know, officially they came from Texas. Nobody in Texas will admit it. They said they're a bunch of family carpetbaggers from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And thought they were rather better than other people allowed they were. But he was busy making phone calls to the FBI saying, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald or somebody like that was responsible. Just a tip from the old head of the CIA here. How are you guys doing, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, keep up the good fight. Pep talks.
Well, what I also found interesting in Russ's expose was that supposedly George H.W. Bush was asked where he was, and he couldn't remember that day where he was. I was six years old, and I remember where I was when I found out Kennedy was assassinated.
I'm not so sure I would remember forever, and he was a friend of mine.
Oh, I remember. I was 6 years old. I was standing by the jungle gym.
6 years old was more impressionable than 120 or whatever I was.
Yeah.
No, it was a time of great confusion. And don't you think the powers of darkness, under cover of the darkness, particularly then and more with 9/11, that was a, boy, that was a bonanza for them.
Well, I wanted to talk about that, actually. I'm glad you brought it up, because you had a statement you made in May of 2007, and you said that you're not a conspiracy theorist, you're a conspiracy analyst. And at that point, you thought that the Bushes weren't capable of planning 9/11, but you pretty much, you know, believe that they stepped aside and allowed it to happen.
Well, whether they stepped aside or they stumbled aside isn't terribly important.
Right.
I mean, just as in the case of 9/11, all the warnings we were getting that there were unfriendly skies, you know, clouding our view of the world, and there they were, and trouble was coming for us, and even Osama bin Laden was mentioned as being the man who was going to deliver this treat to us. So we were getting plenty of information. Israel warned us about it. The Russians warned us. I think the Egyptians warned us that trouble was coming out of the sky. But the press now is so loathed by American people, and television is regarded as an annoyance, nobody pays any attention. Now, if I wanted to take over a country, the first thing I would do would be to destroy any authenticity that the press might have. Luckily, for conspirators, they don't have to have any now.
Mm-hmm.
They can commit every crime on earth, and they'll get away with it. Nobody will question them. Now, where is the average person going to find out anything? And it's very touching, because I go around, as you do, teach speaking here and there around the country.
Mm-hmm.
The question I most get, from just, you know, honest folk that have come out for information, they said, where do you get your information?
Right.
I said, I thought it was all public domain. I don't have anything secret.
Mm-hmm.
I never have had. I can tell you things that were secrets at the time, like, you know, the Kennedy administration, other malefactors. But by and large, the Kennedys never tried anything as god-awful as what was going on in the Bush reign, which was really a coup d'etat against the Republic of the United States.
Well, absolutely. If who do you think really was responsible for 9/11? Do you really think it was Osama? And
well, let's let him have credit. He wants it.
Mm-hmm.
If I had done it, I wouldn't want credit, because it didn't turn out. It made a great mess. It frightened the United States. Well, I must say, it did one great thing. If you hate the United States, which these people apparently do, have
mm-hmm.
proven elsewhere that they do,
mm-hmm.
what greater thing than to get rid of the Republic, to get rid of due process of law? That was one of the first things we lost.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And like you said, the day that habeas corpus died and the USA Patriot Act. So, you know, that attack really accomplished a lot.
You know, one detail about the USA Patriot Act, which was not even the Soviet Union at its very worst ever came up with anything like that.
Right.
But there it is. And you know where the Bush people got it from? It was sitting on a shelf in the Justice Department. As a result of Timothy McVeigh, about whom I've written at length, which is an interesting non-conspiracy story, but a very interesting sign of rebellion among the American people who don't like what's been done to them. And this is the farmer class from upstate New York, say, as he was, from Buffalo. And they've lost the meaning for their lives. His grandfather had a farm. Timothy McVeigh loved guns and was a great hero in the Gulf War.
Right.
And the Army wanted him back. This has all been, you see everybody's a villain. And he's a lone, crazed killer.
Right.
He wants to kill Americans because he's mean. He didn't want to kill Americans. He didn't want to kill children in that public building. He didn't know about it. I've got a batch of letters that he started to write me from death row.
Right.
And they check out to me, certainly. How would he know things that only the prosecutors later might know? Anyway, at the time, the Justice Department wrote up just a suspension of all law, of all, you know, due process and everything else.
Uh-huh.
It was on the book, and there it was. It's been all written up, ready to enact. This is under the divine Clinton, whom I very much admire most of the time. But every now and then, he and Janet Reno would come up with something really ghastly. And that
absolutely. The Branch Davidian thing.
It was the Branch Davidian and Ruby Ridge and all of that. Did it, and that is when the poor boy from Buffalo got it. He got enraged by that. You know, he was a first-rate constitutional scholar. No, he didn't go to many universities, but that's how you learn things, I discovered. And he was an extraordinary patriot who acted upon his emotions rather too forcibly. I wrote him a couple of letters in which I sort of teased him because I said, don't you think you perhaps overdid your vengeance on the federal government for what they had done to the Branch Davidians and what they had done to the unfortunate family at Ruby Ridge, all of whom had been murdered at the beds.
Right.
And he had actually witnessed some of the activities in Waco, which is where the Branch Davidians had their religion.
Right.
And we burned down their meeting house. We burned down their children, their wives. It was a horrible thing. Very Hitlerian, which the Bushes were beginning to more and more resemble. Oh, you can't say they were like Hitler, you know. You immediately start that argument.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do say they were. And did more damage to the United States than Hitler did to us.
Well, you said, and we know in the Oklahoma City bombing that children were killed too. How was he getting back at the federal government for killing children?
He didn't know there were any children involved, and I believe him.
Oh.
He said, how would I know?
That there was a preschool there?
No, he said, they don't give guided tours of the McCullough building, whatever it's called. You don't get a guided tour. He'd gone in to look at it to see, you know, how bangable the thing was, and he was going to blow it up.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been interesting had he got away with it to the extent that we might find out he'd be more open about his motives. Because to me, he was very open and very clear. And I list all the letters that he wrote to me, and there must have been about 20 brilliant ones, full of the Constitution. You know, when the judge who got fond of him, he's a monster. You see, when anything like that happens, they say, oh, he wanted to kill the children. That's what he wanted to do first. Then he wanted to kill the women and everybody else. And then he wanted to suffer. Then, you know, they have all this nonsense because he's a lone, crazed killer.
Right.
They have that ready for anybody who, you know, spits on the sidewalk.
Well, that's one of my myths. I wrote a new book called Myth America, and one of my myths is if anybody is ever assassinated in this country, that it's done by a lone gunman. There's never any conspiracies in this country about anything.
And there's nothing but conspiracy. What are the two-party system? But, you know, a con game and a vicious conspiracy deprive the people of any say in their government. And we have none.
Well, you wrote something back in the 70s that I think was pretty brilliant. Well, I think you're brilliant. Almost everything you say and write, I think, is brilliant.
Thank you.
But I just want to go back to the McVeigh thing. You know, I think that our government is so violent. Our government is so out of control with their state-sanctioned murder of innocent people, and, you know, right here in our country with the death penalty and everything. And I just don't think that we can counter it ourselves by also killing innocent people. I think the government is a legitimate target, but, you know, killing innocent people, I don't think, is a way to get your point across.
Well, first of all, he didn't know who was in that building. He knew the Bureau of Alcohol, mm-hmm. which he had it in for, because they've been shooting a lot of innocent people, and I think they're the ones who blamed Ruby Ridge people. Because they had alcohol, or they were selling it or something. They had it, you know, tall stories.
Well, it's unfortunate that, like in a federal building, the targets would probably be just like bureaucrats that are just wage slaves, which is unfortunate.
Well, that's what he ended up, you know, doing.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, unfortunately.
I'll tell you something that is not generally known, because the American media and our ruling class doesn't want anybody to know it. They have to know he's a monster.
Right.
Lone, crazed killer.
Right.
Wandered around looking for people to blow up.
Right.
He was none of these things. He was a very scholarly young man and a hero of the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army wanted him back. They wanted him desperately. He was a great shot. And he was a real soldier. I mean, he was not kidding. And when he'd taken his various oaths to uphold the Constitution, so he believed them.
He took them seriously.
Now, he was asked, I'm going to say this because your audience will never have heard it before,
mm-hmm.
and will never hear it again. The judge took a liking to him. It's this judge who's condemning him to death. And I said, why did you take death instead of life imprisonment? Oh, he said, I'd rather be dead than be in a cement block hole for the rest of my natural days.
Right.
But here's what it is. This is part of the public record. The judge said, well, sir, you have been silent. You have made no defense of what you've done. You've made no explanation of it. The judge was getting a little irritated, too. But he said, now that I am about to pronounce sentence on you, and it is what I assume you fear, could you tell us something so that this is not an enigma for all time? Why you did it? It's very rare somebody who doesn't like the Pure Drug and Food Act comes along and blows up a building filled with presumably innocent bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do it? And he said, well, Your Honor, the only time he spoke in his own trial, this is himself, Timothy McVeigh. He said, I have listened to the people who think I am guilty, and I am certainly guilty of the crime of which I am accused. I did blow up that building. He said, and I will try to make myself clear briefly. He already understood TV talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I am going to quote to you Justice Brandeis in his dissent in the Olmstead case in 1920 or whatever it was. And he said, I think it applicable to what I did. It's the first time he's spoken.
Mm-hmm.
The judge said, well, do you want to read it? He said, no, I know it by heart. He said, Justice Brandeis said, government must never forget. It is the great teacher. And when government thinks that it can take shortcuts and government can go round the laws as they exist, and government can do anything, and he's talking about what happened at Ruby Ridge and what happened to the Branch Davidians.
Mm-hmm.
It's fierce. And he said, I'll show them a bit of the citizen's business, too. like that.
Right. Whew, that was really that was really deep. Let's shift gears a little bit. We only have about 3 minutes left. I was reading one of your books, and you called the Democrats and the Republicans the Bankers Party. What do you think about that now, especially when one of our senators a few weeks ago said that the bankers still own Congress?
That what's on Congress?
The bankers still own Congress.
Oh, I almost say now, who cares? We've known about this for a long, long time. I was brought up in Washington from the day I was born. And my grandfather was president of the Senate and head of the banking committee and this and that and so on. He was one of the people who ran the country.
Right.
But he was generally benign. He was not a war lover. And my God, he lost his seat twice. Due to his opposition to the executive wars, as we should usefully call them, one being Woodrow Wilson's war and the second one being FDR's goading of the Japanese into attacking us at Pearl Harbor. No, that's not a conspiracy notion.
Right.
All you have to do is read an interesting book by Harry Hopkins, who was Roosevelt's right-hand man.
Right.
And he went to live in the White House. Mrs. Roosevelt had just moved out, and Pearl Harbor had happened, and he was there just to advise the president, keep him company, and keep him advised. And so I would say, if you want to know what the mood was like at the capital of the country, listen to what went on in the palace. When he said, because Roosevelt knew that the Japanese fleet was headed for Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And we knew that it was not a kindly visit.
Exactly.
And Hopkins, Mrs. Roosevelt wasn't around, but she was usually quick, and I adored her. And I regard her as total virtue, but she certainly liked war when she thought it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought that we should intercept them. And finally, it got down to Harry Hopkins said to the president, said, you know, they're headed straight for Pearl Harbor. The entire fleet is there at the orders of the president. And they should have been at their home base, which was San Diego.
Uh-huh.
Where they would have been relatively safe.
Right.
And the president said, I know that. But he said, it is very important that people do not say that this is Roosevelt's war. And they will. And Hopkins was stunned because Roosevelt was a friend. He was his great leader.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, what a funny thing. But Roosevelt went right on. He said, they'll make it Roosevelt's war, and it'll be a worthless war because they will attribute to me all sorts of motives which they've invented as they go along. Well, that was a bit about the first crashing defeat that the United States has ever had. It was a president who had the wisdom to realize what the other leaders of the so-called free world did not realize. Hitler was something new, and politicians are only used to what is very old.
Right.
So they thought, oh, it's another German Bismarck, who, after all, we could have lived with him quite well. He was rather kindly old thing. And suddenly Roosevelt, alone of world leaders, said, this guy isn't just fun and games. This guy is, you know, we call everybody evil because everybody is evil if they stand in the way of United States of America.
Right.
And of course they can be pretty wicked if they feel like it, but we have this evil thing, and to have a president slightly drenched in the blood of the lamb, as was Bush, he just knows enough scripture to muddy everything with it. And suddenly, you know, he just starts the blood of the lamb number, and we know what the lamb is. He's holy, and he will protect us from badness.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I hope
the United States, madam.
I know, exactly. I hope you can come back again and talk to us. This has been very fascinating. But you did say a few minutes ago that this is old stuff, that we've known about it for a long time. Well, not everybody has known about it for a long time. And that's why
how do you get it to them? You know,
yeah, why your voice is so important. That's why what you say and what you've been saying for decades now is so important for people to know, because it's not new stuff. It's all just like generations old. So, Gore, thanks for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Please say you'll come on again soon.
Please stay on.
We will. Thank you. We really appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. Keep getting well. Keep getting stronger.
Oh, glory.
Thank you. Wow, that was intellectual Gore Vidal. That was just an amazing interview that I was so happy to have. Hopefully, Gore will come back on again, and I'll have to expand my show several hours. But anyway, this is Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. We'll be right back after this short break with our Ask Cindy question. Stay tuned.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. Those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehansSoapbox.com and at Rational Radio 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas. We are not going to have a rant today because I wanted to give Gore Vidal as much time as possible for the interview to really listen to his wisdom. So today we do have an Ask Cindy question. And my Ask Cindy question today is called, Where's Cindy Sheehan? This is from Debbie. And she signs her email, Debbie, mom of a 20-year-old male. To Cindy, my husband and I were at the dinner table Monday night listening to the news where they said that 22,000 more troops were being sent to Afghanistan and that July was the bloodiest month for loss of life for the U.S. troops. I looked at my husband and said, where's Cindy Sheehan? You represented that mom who hated an unjust war and, in fact, camped out in Texas. I'm just curious as to why you are not speaking out against the current administration other than, say, on blogs, etc. Signed, Debbie, mom of a 20-year-old male. Well, Debbie, I get this sort of email a lot these days. Some go so far as to call me a hypocrite for not opposing Obama and the wars that became his on January 20th, 2009. If I respond to these emails, I usually say that I'm opposing the wars, and just because you don't see me on Fox or CNN doesn't mean that it's not happening. I participated in many protests since Obama was inaugurated. I've been in protests against the wars, against the Federal Reserve, against the U.S.-Israeli aggression on Gaza, and against the U.S. silence on the coup in Honduras, etc. I've spoken in about 30 cities since April, focusing on the class division in this country that keeps us in wars and is widening the income disparity. I haven't been still or silent. As a fierce critic of the system, whether it has a Republican face or a Democratic face, I don't think criticism of me is necessarily valid, but I often wonder myself, where's the movement? The anti-Republican war movement has lost a lot of credibility by its allowing the Democrats to co-opt it for their power. The Democrats won't end the war, and that's why I left the party long ago. Thanks for your question, Sue. Now for your listener soapbox assignment of the week. The 20 most powerful global economies will be meeting in Pittsburgh September 24th to 27th, and we need to go there in force to protest the harmful policies of globalization, the IMF, and the World Bank. Go to www.bailoutpeople.org. That's www.bailoutpeople.org for more information. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there. Well, okay, that's our soapbox for today. I'd like to thank my special guest, Gore Vidal. As always, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my assistant producer, Mikey. I'd like to thank David Clifton at Rational Radio in Dallas, Texas, for putting me on the air, and especially you, the listeners. We're switching up our closing a little bit today. We're going to hear from Mario Savio, a speech he gave in Berkeley against the war machine. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
You know, I just want to say one brief thing about something the previous speaker said. I didn't want to spend too much time on that because I don't think it's important enough, but one thing is worth considering. He's the nominal head of an organization supposedly representative of the undergraduates, whereas in fact, under the Kerr directives, it derives its authority as delegated power from the administration. It's totally unrepresentative of the graduate students and TAs. But he made the following statement. I quote, "I would ask all those who are not definitely committed to the FSM cause to stay away from the demonstration." All right, now listen to this. "For all upper division students who are interested in alleviating the TA shortage problem, I would encourage you to offer your services to department chairmen and advisors." That has two things, a strike breaker and a fink. I'd like to say one other thing about a union problem. Upstairs, you may have noticed already on the second floor of Sproul Hall, locals 40 and 127 of the Painters Union are painting the inside of the second floor of Sproul Hall. Now, apparently that action had been planned sometime in the past. I've tried to contact those unions, unfortunately, and tears my heart out. They're as bureaucratized as the administration. It's difficult to get through to anyone in authority there. Very sad. We're still making an attempt. Those people up there have no desire to interfere with what we're doing. I would ask that they be considered and that they not be heckled in any way. And I think that, you know, while there's unfortunately no sense of solidarity at this point between unions and students, there at least need be no, you know, excessively hard feelings between the two groups. Now, there are at least two ways in which sit-ins and civil disobedience and whatever, at least two major ways in which it can occur. One, when a law exists, is promulgated, which is totally unacceptable to people, and they violate it again and again and again till it's rescinded, appealed. All right. But there's another way. There's another way. Sometimes the form of the law is such to render impossible its effective violation as a method to have it repealed. Sometimes the grievances of people extend more to more than just the law, extend to a whole mode of arbitrary power, a whole mode of arbitrary exercise of arbitrary power. And that's what we have here. We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings. And that brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. That doesn't mean, and it will be interpreted to mean, unfortunately, by the bigots who run the Examiner, for example. That doesn't mean that you have to break anything. 1,000 people sitting down someplace, not letting anybody buy, not letting anything happen, can stop any machine, including this machine, and it will stop. We're going to do the following. And the greater the number of people, the safer they'll be, and the more effective it will be. We're going, once again, to march up to the second floor of Sproul Hall. And we're going to conduct our lives for a while in the second floor of Sproul Hall. We'll show movies, for example. We tried to get Enchant d'Amour. Unfortunately, that's tied up in the court because of a lot of squeamish moral mothers for a moral America and other people on the outside. The same people who get all their ideas out of the San Francisco Examiner. Sad, sad. But Mr. Landau has gotten us some other films. Likewise, we'll do something which hasn't occurred at this university in a good long time. We're going to have real classes up there. There are going to be freedom schools conducted up there. We're going to have classes on the First and 14th Amendments. We're going to spend our time learning about the things this university is afraid that we know. We're going to learn about freedom up there, and we're going to learn by doing.